I'd like to offer some reflections on the theme, and also to leave some time for some exploration, discussion together. And in the spirit of the way we've been practicing today, just to see if the listening to the reflections can be an embodied listening. Now, the point of teachings isn't to promulgate some nice ideas, right, which we might agree with or disagree with, or worst of all, maybe find interesting. But to point to the way experience is in such a way that we can connect what's being reflected on to our own experience, to find out how that happens for me here in such a way as, oh, to light that up for us, to deepen our contact with our experience, to open up our understanding of our experience. So the more we listen within ourselves, if you like, I mean, listen from experience and let the teachings and whatever said land here, the more chance there is for that to happen. So I'll try to speak about some of the things that get in the way of this simple practice we've been speaking about. Hard to think of a simpler practice, right? Body's here, experience is here, pay attention to it, and all things shall be added unto you. Right? And yet, how we seem to get adept at doing everything other than just being here. So to explore a little bit some of the things that get in the way, and also then some of the fruits as our skill with just being embodied deepens. And one of the things that gets in the way, of course, is just general forgetfulness, just forgetting. I think as Sharon Salzberg says, it's easy to practice mindfulness. We just need to remember to do it. Yeah. And therein, in that remembering. In fact, the root of sati, the Pali word that's, the one that's basically been translated as mindfulness, sati, literally the root of it, it means to recall, or to remember. To remember where one is. To recall one's attention. To come back to oneself. So part of what gets in the way of that is just the forgetting, just that we're so seduced by the abstractions and the momentum of our doing and the rehearsal and the replay and the inner drama, etc. That we're so seduced by that that we forget to be where we are. And so some of the mechanisms of practice address that. I mean, just having a steady daily meditation practice is a real good support for that remembering. The willingness to slow down a little is a really good support for remembering. Very often we're moving at a speed that's actually faster than we need to be. And of course, if you're late for the bus, you've got to move fast. But much of the time, we're moving fast through habit or momentum or obsession about what it is, what I'm doing and where I'm going with it. And just the willingness to keep slowing down with that. And even when we have to move fast and we have to run for the bus, then, often the inner momentum is kind of going at an unnecessarily stressful pace that can be softened, even though the outer momentum has to be getting to the bus stop. So, just the stuff of the more, they're just those reminders of practice as an aid to some kind of combating our everyday forgetfulness. And you might be an app that rings every hour to say hello, you know, it's here, or whatever. The three classic forces that pull us away from being present, forces that classically in Buddhism are called greed, hatred, and delusion, the forces that some of you are familiar with me speaking about as demand, defense, and distraction. And I thought to speak about those a little today, particularly in terms of relational life. Like in the speaking exercise earlier, an opportunity to see, you know, so much of our lives is relational. And we spoke earlier a little bit about the tendency in relationship either to kind of to exteriorize and go out to the other and lose contact with ourselves, or to sort of withdraw and shut down and in that way sort of tighten into ourselves. And given that so much of our lives are relational, and given that this practice is so often taught in a kind of silent or solitary context, that bridging doesn't necessarily happen so easily. And we can even somehow build the association with silence and meditation and practice to the extent that it feels like I have to be alone to be mindful, or I have to be quiet to be mindful. And if that's the case, well, good luck living in London. But actually, like we've been emphasizing today, awareness is here, experience is here. Communication's no barrier to being mindful. So if we look at that pattern, we can see in what we might call the compulsive tendency, the contracted tendency, and the comfort tendency. Right? So the compulsive tendency to lose ourselves in the other relationally. And of course, the more intense the relationship, the more intense the pattern of that. So some relationships, you know, intimate relationships, very close working relationships, you might get to see that especially strongly. And for some of us, we recognize that pattern as being more primary, right? The going out to the other. One of two ways, usually, either pleasing, and this isn't an exhaustive list, but just some reflections. Either pleasing or presenting. And so some of us go, oh, and it's all about the other in terms of what do they need and how can I agree with them and support them and make them feel okay and reassure them. And one finds one sort of giving oneself away, as it were. Oh yes, very nice, very good. Oh, you're so right. In some version of that. It's hard to maintain the sense of what's happening. Hard to stay embodied in experience when one's not only involved in the other generally, but there's that kind of that raising up. The others become, oh, I've got to please and sort of submit to the other. Opposite pattern, if not pleasing, then sometimes presenting. And this one, the other's rather almost irrelevant. There's still going out, but there's the going out in terms of my own self-image and who I am and what I do and where I've been. And so it's not a staying with oneself. It's just, it's all about me, but it's about the image I'm producing, presenting, posturing, impressing the other with. For those with the outer tendency, and as I said, it's not an exhaustive list, but those seem to be the two main ways we lose ourselves in going out to the other, pleasing or presenting. And then the opposite tendency for some of us, the more withdrawn tendency, also has two ways, which I call, these things have just come to me, by the way, this morning. And those of you who know me well, you know I like mnemonics, right? So if you're staying in track, you'll notice there's three C's. Compulsive, contracted, and comfort. And the compulsive one has two P's, pleasing and presenting. Now the contracted one has two H's, right? Hiding and hoping. So some of the withdrawal tendency is that we just want to hide. want to separate. Right? We're kind of waiting in the contact for it to be over. We're looking for the exit. As we begin the conversation, then we're already trying to get to the, where's the end of this conversation? Ah, so I can withdraw as if to safety. But it's that drive to hide isn't a coming back to oneself. Right? It isn't settling into experience. The very act of hiding, withdrawing, contracting, is a kind of aloneness that defines itself in terms of the other, apart from other, safe from other, etc. And so, even though it's not a landing in, it's a withdrawal from that tends to increase the sense of isolation or difference or separation. So that seems to be one half of the more withdrawing response to relationship, communication, being with others. Or the other withdrawing pattern, hoping. So I'm sort of withdrawing my own, but I'm hoping that whoever the you is, will discover me, attune to me, come to me, hold me, love me, see how deserving of attention I am. So sometimes you might notice that, right? Like at the lunchtime there. It's like, well, I won't go out because I don't need to speak, particularly I'm in silence. But somebody could notice me and come and sit down, talk to me, etc. So hiding and hoping. And it's not that any of these are wrong or particularly pathological. I mean, they're only average pathological. They're only pathological like most of ego activity, or all of ego activity, we might say, is pathological to a certain extent. In as much as, in some way, it's going against our real best interests. Right? Part of us, the part that's committed to come here today, part of us that knows the depth and beauty of Dharma practice, the part of us that's willing to sit in meditation, which doesn't, in worldly sense, doesn't give much reward. Right? There's nothing glamorous about meditation. Right? The part of us does that because it recognizes the kind of the profundity and the promise of dropping that pathological ego activity. So it's only everyday pathological, this stuff. But so it's not to attune to it as some way of judging myself. Oh my God, that's so much what I do, that pleasing thing or that hiding thing or whatever. But actually as an invitation to just to get to know one's style. And it's not necessarily that you have one or other of these styles, but an opportunity to see so that you recognize when you're leaning out of yourself, or you recognize when you're withdrawing into yourself. Recognize it so you can explore it. Explore it so you can understand it. Understand it so you can see whether you actually need to go out. Whether you actually need to withdraw. Whether you actually need to hold the tension pattern that's inevitably there, driving that pattern along. Or whether it's possible to soften it some. And then the other relational pattern we tend to have, and the comfort one, is not usually so much about other people, but normally about relating to something, to some object that gives comfort. For some it's food. Food as something just to absorb the attention into. For some it might be TV. Just plug into the TV. Increasingly, it's the phone. Some form of breast surrogate, basically. If you sense into it, at least it seems that's the way it seems to me. And you know, I really notice it with the phone. It's like, it's just something to, and whatever your thing or things of choice are, something to an object to absorb the attention into, which actually gives some kind of breast-like, you know, if you really watch a child breastfeeding, their eyes kind of glaze over. They just like, oh, it's fabulous. They lie afterwards and they just, and then burp a bit. Like, and the various things that we seek some kind of unconscious comfort in seems like some kind of attempt to recreate that. Anyway, regardless of one can go into the psychology of it, it's not actually not just abstract psychology. Because one can actually make a very strong visceral connection with that. And just as one's capacity to generally rest in awareness deepens, and particularly to not rely on usual awareness, everyday awareness is animated by cognitive mechanisms, right? We're aware of what's happening, but we're aware of it in terms of our descriptions. This, that, here, there, me, you, what I'm doing, where I'm going, etc. As we leave alone our cognitive apparatus, increasingly through meditation, we develop more and more capacity for non-conceptual awareness. A meeting with and an awareness of and a relationship with what's happening that's not dependent on any kind of imagery or description. And as that non-conceptual awareness deepens, then all kinds of other non-conceptual experience becomes available. Non-conceptual or pre-conceptual memory, for example, becomes available. And so we might access memories that conceptual awareness can't access. Like very, very early memories. Even memories, you know, in the womb. Well, conceptual awareness can't remember memories of being in the womb because there was no concept going on in the room. No thinking capacity was there in the room. But experience was there. So it has to have some facility with non-conceptual awareness to access pre-conceptual memory. Does that make sense? So, for instance, I have now very strong and clear memories, non-conceptual memories, of being at the breast. I can remember it very, like a very full-bodied memory. And that sense of the kind of the greediness with which I sucked. My family called me when I was a baby, the Michelin man. Because I was so fat and I had great rolls, like babies sometimes do. Great rolls of fat. I was very good. And I don't know, I see my psychology, it totally makes sense. And I also have very strong memories of just that sense of the absorption as an infant, the absorption into the object, the supreme object. Right, the breast. It's the first object, the breast, the main object. And of course, those of you who are psychologists or psychotherapists and can make the link with object relations and breast complex and all of that. But I'm going off on one of these tangents that really part of your talk, but it's been astonishing to me to see how the comfort response in whatever it is, you know, whether it's that I'm just checking my phone even though I checked it a few minutes ago, or whether I'm just, you know, whatever your thing is, whether it's food, whether it's TV, whether it's whatever you like to absorb your attention into, like, so as to give it to the object. And the opportunity in that to see how there's a kind of the sort of longing for bliss, basically. Longing for to disappear. Longing to just somehow unite with the object. And how it's shot through with the idea that the object can somehow hold me, satiate me, complete me, satisfy me, etc. And that comfort response is another way in which we kind of give ourselves away to whatever the object is. So sometimes it might be helpful, just as we explore those, compulsive outgoing of pleasing and presenting to others, that contracted withdrawal of hiding and hoping that we do, that comfort absorption that we seek through whatever objects. And the counterpoint to that is, what am I doing if I'm not doing any of those things? What am I doing when I'm walking down the street? What am I doing in the moment when the telephone conversation finishes and I put the phone down? What am I doing in the moment where I say goodbye and somebody leaves and I close the door? Particularly interesting to put those moments where the relationship with the person or with the pattern or with the object just ends. Right? Either because it just comes to an end, the phone call ends, the conversation ends, the TV program ends, or because I actually choose to reorientate my my attention away from the fixation to what's actually happening, to actually see it as it's still a giving of attention, but a giving attention to what's here. Right. That's what our whole practice is about, giving attention to what's here. And it can be rather sobering to see, given that I love this practice, I'm committed to this practice. It can be rather sobering to see how much I give my attention away. Give our attention away rather than giving our attention to what's here. And then for myself in my practice, there's a point at which I started just to value that, this giving my attention to what's here more, in a way that I started to call, I'm spending time with myself, or I'm hanging out with myself, or I'm talking to myself, if you like, or whatever. It's like somewhere valuing this inner orientation of attention. Because I noticed, even though I loved this practice and I go on retreat a lot and etc. etc., I noticed that actually the ego momentum wanted to just give my attention away all the time. So, relationally, I think it's interesting, it's important, it's maybe sobering, it's really helpful to just pay attention with where does your attention go? Not as a way to judge it, but as a way just to see, does it need to go there? As a way to see, what's it like if I bring it back? As a way to see, maybe what's here is really deserving of attention. And when there's the support and the structure of meditation, it's like a whole setup on a day like this is set up to give attention to what's here. But then in the everyday relationships or activities of life, just that reflection, when the setup isn't there, just to see how much I can value giving attention to what's here. Or to see what's the belief when I'm busy wanting to give attention elsewhere in some way. And that seeking out for some comfort. And that going out to try and please or impress. And that withdrawal to try and protect or get away from, to hide from or to hope for, etc. Another thing that gets in the way of embodiment, a little like we were hearing earlier, when there's particularly difficult experience when there's trauma, particularly early trauma, maybe trauma we know about, maybe trauma we don't even know about, which of course sometimes is the nature of trauma, that kind of buried it below what we're aware of. And that tendency to just find the being in touch with body very confronting or fearful or impossible even. And like we were saying a little bit this morning, which is why I wanted to underline it today, when if there's some area of experience of that we just can't come into, and that when we do, it generates a lot of fear, or we just find ourselves sort of strongly bouncing away from it, then it's kind of usually needs the skillful work with somebody else who can do some of that holding to make it feel possible, even to approach, to sense into whatever it is that feels so difficult there. Another thing that makes it difficult to practice embodiment is the belief we have that if I'm to, in the language I've just been using, give attention to what's here, if I'm to be present in my body, if I'm to just to come into contact with whatever's going on in bodily life just as it is, the belief that that ought to feel a certain way, that I ought to feel peaceful, for example, or that what I ought to discover when I do that, oh, I turn my attention to what's here, I ought to discover some kind of spacious, pleasant, meditative, sort of whoosh, kind of feeling. That belief is really an impediment. Because then when I do, in the midst of, you know, the stimulation of life, when I realize, oh, I've gotten busy, I've gotten speedy, I've gotten implicated, I've gotten caught in some ego momentum. And then when I do turn my attention, when I find that it's like, it's kind of electric and buzzy inside, oh my God, it doesn't correspond with my view of wanting to feel peaceful, and that's what meditation's about. So what do? I'll just go back to being busy and try and forget about it. Right? Some chuckles of recognition. Often what happens when we first attune to what's here from a place of being implicated in something is we can feel the implication energetically. You can feel the ego momentum. You can feel the electricness of being, you know, like that. So what our practice actually invites us to do is to be willing to feel that buzz, to feel that electric feeling. Not to try and cool it out or make it peaceful, just to attune to it, just to let yourself actually stand there, sit there, lie there, whatever, and feel it. You can't make it stop, but you can stop feeding it. And when you stop feeding it, like anything that's, you know, when it's not being fed, it'll wither away, it'll cool out, it'll fade. But it might take a few moments, it might take a few minutes. And that's such an important connection to make, right? To make that experiential connection, that when I first attune to what's happening, if I've been provoked, stimulated, agitated by something, then what I'll feel is the provocation, the stimulation, the agitation. But that actually the more I can just let it be felt, let it be stimulating, or let it be electric, even though that may be uncomfortable in some way, the more I can let it do its thing, the more it will cool out. That's the nature of everything, right? Everything, the nature of everything is to arise and express and fade. And we get the insight of that with every breath in meditation. And whatever that energetic momentum is, it only lasts while it's being supported. When you stop feeding it, it starts to cool out. And then that track from being caught in ego momentum to actually attuning to experience, to it cooling out, to knowing this a certain quality of ease and rest, that track or that process becomes smoother, more fluid, becomes easier, becomes quicker, becomes more efficient. But if we have the view that to attune to my experience should feel peaceful, we'll keep bouncing off it every time it doesn't, every time it feels agitated or busy in some way. So it's like cultivating the art of attuning to ego momentum without making it wrong, without trying to make it go away. Letting yourself feel it so that it can wind itself out. It's like a clockwork toy, right? If you've been winding it up all day, and then, oh no, it's all wound up now. What am I going to do? Right? I don't want to let go of the winding handle, because then it's going to go... Right? But so I'll keep holding the winding handle, so I don't have to feel the... But if you keep holding the winding handle, that takes a lot of work. That's stressful and exhausting in itself. And it's true that when you let go of the winding handle, you have to feel the... But then, by just letting yourself feel it, then you get to the gzzz. So you learn to let your system come to rest. Let your nervous system come to rest. Let your attention come to rest. And then, that sense we were speaking about this morning of actually, getting the fruits of knowing this certain ease. Certain pleasantness. Here, wherever here is actually always the right place to be. Even if what's happening here is complicated, difficult, feels unsafe even. Better to be here in the midst of what's going on rather than lost in one's reactions to fears of etc. What's going on? So, in a quite ordinary way, we actually start to get the fruits of practice as a certain happiness of being here. It turns out that happiness is an art. I'm going to Bhutan next week to speak at a TEDx conference on happiness. So Bhutan is the country of happiness. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a heavy burden to bear. Right? When you've set it up, when you've set up the oppressive rhetoric of happiness, right? We measure our gross national happiness here. Everybody's happy in Bhutan. Oh my God. Turns out that in Bhutan they have high adolescent suicide rate. And so, of course, the rhetoric of happiness, one should be happy, we're all happy, that can feel like a pretty heavy burden to bear when inevitably, some mornings, when we get unhappy. Adolescents, for example, it's almost your job to be unhappy as an adolescent. Right? And starting to question what identity is and who one is in the world, and trying to negotiate the sort of separation from parents, etc., etc. That tends to be miserable at times. And yet, if you've got a culture around you that's telling you we're all happy here, and then you're miserable. At least you're miserable in a country where a culture where everyone's complaining all the time. It's normal to be miserable. Miserable in a culture where everyone tells you you're supposed to be happy, everyone's happy here, then that might really increase the sense, God, there must be really something wrong with me. So happiness, it turns out, it's a rather ambiguous term. What does happiness mean? Usually what we mean by happiness, usually what we take for happiness, would better be called consumptive gratification. Right? What makes you happy? It's one of the questions I want to ask at the TEDx conference. What makes you happy? Because it's actually an important question. It's actually a question that has a lot of reflective potency to it. What makes me happy? And you might just reflect yourself. What makes you happy? And this or this that might arise. The usual things we're culturally, I was going to say programmed, that's a little bit heavy, various things we're culturally conditioned to go towards tend, first things, to be the consumptive gratifications that make us happy. I like this, I like that. And one of the maps the Buddha uses is a map of kind of the refinement of happiness. It turns out, you know, happiness is an art. We need happiness training to learn actually how to be happy, in the sense of how to be content with what is, contained within the immediacy of the moment. There was some interesting research done recently, which found that when people were doing some simple task, right, the general tendency in doing a simple task is, well, it's boring, repetitive, mundane task, so you let mind go anywhere, you think about anything. The famous meditator's example is always washing dishes. I don't know why it's always about washing dishes, but right? Anytime anyone references being mindful in daily life, it's always while doing the dishes. Some esoteric power that dishwashing has. So one washes the dishes. And the research found that people are doing these simple everyday tasks reported being much happier doing the task when they were really focusing on doing the task. It's interesting, right? Because the natural tendency of the normal untrained mind doing the dishes doesn't focus. Normal untrained mind, in other words, doesn't know how to be happy. The normal untrained mind knows how to be distracted, knows how to be demanding, knows how to be defensive, knows how to get compulsive, knows how to get contracted, knows how to seek comfort. So this practice of embodiment, this practice of coming back to what is, this practice of inhabiting experience, it's a practice of, it's happiness training. And then, as our skill in that happiness training deepens, as we learn to increasingly trust, like we were saying earlier this morning, to trust hanging out here, to trust our experience of bodily life rather than our image of what body is or our description of what body is, right? As we increasingly, in other words, are able to experience the full fluidity of this field of experience that we call body, rather than just constantly referring to the sense of body as a thing, right? That's the usual sense of body, it's a thing. And so we try to sense into body, it seems to go, it's about that wide, right, body. You go, sense into your body, there's about that much room. And then that's it. Right? And then if you try to take your attention outwards from body, it's like, oh, it goes out to there, that's it. Or we might have some sense, like, just sort of extends a little bit beyond, because sometimes if someone comes up behind me, I know. Mysteriously. So we might say, well, it sort of goes a little bit out, and there's a little bit in. But body seems like a very fixed, narrow, limited place to be. Body seems like a particular thing. And even though it's changing all the time, oh, well, it's aging all the time, oh, well, the sensations are fluid, our relationship to the body, as we call it, seems to be a relationship to a thing called body. But as we trust our practice more, as we sense into experience it more, as we actually learn to relax more into body, that sense of body as thing can't hold up. And we increasingly start to actually have an experiential relationship with body as this open field of experience. And somebody came to speak to me in one of the gaps for walking meditation, spoke about it as a sense of permeability. It's a nice word, right? The sense of what we call body feels increasingly permeable to life. I'm less concerned by the seeming boundary, the imagined boundary, the constructed boundary of where what I call body ends and where what I call world begins. And when we sense, we let attention go outwards. We find, oh, there's no place where awareness stops. Right? You can just feel. Go outwards. And then what's heard is included. What's sensed is included. There's no place, there's no hard edge to awareness. There's no hard edge to your sense of yourself. There's no hard edge to this body's receptivity. Turns out that when we just sense outwards, we find an infinite inclusivity. We find that, like we said at the start of the day, that the universe is all included. There's nothing outside of our experience. Which is profoundly relieving to the one who feels generally separate, apart from. The one who feels they have to either go out to try and get to the other, or have to withdraw from in order to keep apart from the other. You sense your experience that has no edges. You start to actually include the rest of the world in here, in this heart, in this experience, in this life. And when you sense inward, you actually sense inward, you find great depths. You can't get to the center of yourself. Wherever you go with your attention, however delicately, however precisely, however finely you take your attention into the field of experience, it just keeps opening up. There's more to discover. More space, more content, more life, more appearances, more disappearances, more stillness, more movement. Great depth. And that's really the fruits of our practice that start to open up. An experience of body, an experience of life that has no edge and no centre, but which is right here, always here, infallibly here. Always available. Just like this. So hence this simple practice, for which all ingredients are available. Awareness is here. Experience is here. Body is extraordinarily sensitive and receptive to the touch of life. So we remember it, so we come back to it, so we explore it, so we dare increasingly to trust it, to rest into it, to listen to it. And it opens up in both directions, to great inclusivity and to great depths of experience. Somebody said to me earlier today, the more I practice, the less I feel I know. I say, oh, marvellous. It's true. And yet the less we feel we know, the more we're struck by the unknowable, immediate, expansive imminence of life. But don't take my word for it. Right? Give attention to what's here. And let's see what fruits that might give. So, those were some reflections on the way we've been practicing. And we have a little time for whatever else you might...